Welcome to Journey's Fire, a weekly program for the visionary and the passionate soul on a mission. I'm Richard Brendan, professional speaker, life purpose coach, counselor, and former hospice chaplain. My purpose in life is to inspire the fire that burns within you and reawaken your heart for love, life, and work. Each week, I'll be bringing you engaging conversations with today's visionary leaders and social change artists. I believe that true fulfillment begins when we say yes to our dreams and take bold and inspired action to design the lives we are created for. Are you ready to live your best life? Well, Journey's Fire begins now. For me, in living our best life, you have to be awake. And I've always believed that the first sign of awakening is usually a growing reverence for life. You find you're deeply appreciative of being alive, that life itself is revealed as a wonder or even a miracle to you. And in your reverence for life, you value the lives of others and of yourself. You perceive life as extremely precious, and that includes the earth, and it certainly includes the animals. Well, you know, in the last few decades, a wealth of new information has emerged about who animals are. Smart, aware, empathic. Studies show that they're astounding beings with intelligence, emotions, intricate communication networks, and myriad abilities. Well, in a new book, Animal Kind, Remarkable Discoveries About Animals and Revolutionary New Ways to Show Them Compassion, authors Ingrid Newkirk and Jean Stone present these findings in a concise and, I would say, awe-inspiring way, detailing a variety of fascinating examples, such as geese fall in love and stay with a partner for life, even at great personal risk. Squirrels bury nuts by the position of the stars. Pigeons navigate by low-frequency radio waves. Fish actually sing underwater. And elephants use their trunks to send subsonic signals, alerting herds a mile or more away to danger or a source of water. Well, it's my honor to have on today's program Ingrid Newkirk, who happens to be the founder and president of People for Ethical Treatment of Animals, known as PETA. It's the largest animal rights organization in the world. She's spoken internationally on animal rights issues, from the steps of the Canadian Parliament to the streets of New Delhi, India, where she spent her childhood. She's also the author of Save the Animals, 100 Things You Can Do, Making Kind Choices, The Compassionate Cook, or Please Don't Eat the Animals, and other books that are all found in multiple languages. I have personally enjoyed this book. It's very inspiring and gives you practical ways of living a more sustainable, ethical life, and it's a joy to have her with me today. Ingrid Newkirk, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Richard. Delighted to be on it.
It's an honor to have you here. I've been a member of PETA for some time, of course, very aware of the work that you all are doing. You founded that organization, I believe, in 1980. Is that correct?
It is. It's a time before most of our staff were born.
I would imagine that's true. I'm curious. I want to get into the book here shortly, but I'd love to hear more about your background. Where did you get that passion that you have for animals?
Oh, I'm not sure, but I was born, I think, or at least I cultivated early, a great disgust at injustice. I don't like bullying. I don't like people to be picked on, and to me, animals are people too. Mm-hmm. So if I see someone berating a child or being mean to anybody, it gets my dander up. And so animals are so helpless. They certainly are in our world.
Yes.
You know, it's supposed to be their world too, but they're not in it.
Mm-hmm.
And when I see people not understand their basic needs, be quick with them, impatient with them, not give them as much time or consideration, then I do get upset.
Where did you decide, and how did you decide to come up with PETA, People for Ethical Treatment of Animals organization?
Well, Richard, it was actually going to be called Justice for Non-Humans originally.
Oh, okay.
But somehow that got lost in the shuffle.
Uh-huh.
And I came up with it because I grew up caring about animals. The quote is, I love animals. And I did, but we ate them. I had my first fur coat when I was 19. And I'd never been inside a laboratory then. I thought that maybe it was just a few animals being used for the good of humanity and taken care of. I had lots of naive thoughts or no thoughts about those sorts of things. But a series of experiences in my early 20s showed me first a fox and a squirrel caught in a steel trap behind a convenience store. And I saw their immense suffering.
Yes.
And I thought, what am I doing wearing fur? I, who love animals. And then, of course, I was a humane officer. I inspected laboratories. I saw awful things happening, which didn't have to happen at all. And I saw the enormity of numbers of animals being used for every fool thing.
Mm-hmm.
And I did investigations on farms. And it was a little pig who really made me stop and think what I was eating, and that if I was against cruelty to the little pig I saw, then I must surely know that there was cruelty in the pig I was eating. So I thought, if I didn't know all these things and I care about animals, there are lots of people like me out there. So maybe I should form a little group and we'll show people what they aren't seeing. And we'll say, I don't want to just make you depressed. I now want to show you what you could do instead, what you eat, what you wear, how you entertain yourself, what you buy, that won't impact negatively on animals, won't cause them suffering.
Yeah. Well, this little organization you started is now, as I said, the largest animal rights organization. I believe you're in 8 countries or more. Is that correct?
We are. I have to count them on my fingers sometimes because I lose track. But we are. And in some countries, for example, we work in Manila in the Philippines. Mm-hmm. In fact, we are now part of this rescue operation for the Atoll volcanic island that has erupted. We're taking animals off there every day in our boat. So we're in Manila. And from Manila, we work in China, because it's hard to set up an office in China these days. There's a lot of nationalism. And we're in Australia, Holland, France, India. We have a major presence there because so many people want to be westernized, and their idea of being westernized means eating lots of meat and dairy and buying leather and
yes.
fur and so on.
Yes.
So we're everywhere.
Yeah. What inspired you to write this specific book, and what is the outcome, the goal that you'd like to achieve with this?
Well, Richard, I'm fascinated by animals, and I collect all sorts of information about them.
Mm-hmm.
But in researching this book, I learned things I didn't know. But the point of the book, it's in two parts. And the first part is to open people's eyes even more, or for the first time, about how incredibly awe-inspiring animals are. Their intelligence, the complexity of their often mysterious communications to each other, and their endurance, and their loyalty to their families, and their amazing talents, and all that sort of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And I'll just give you one small example. I didn't realize that the part in a dog's brain that lights up when you give them a treat is exactly the same part that lights up in a man's brain, a businessman who's given a raise.
Ah,
so
that is fascinating.
Isn't it great? I learned about the fidelity of swans, for example. We have, I think, a 40-45%, I believe it is, divorce rate among humans in this country, that 95% of swans are still with their life mate when they die. Something hasn't befallen them.
Yeah, that is amazing. I shared earlier on before I greeted you on the show that in this book, that geese fall in love and stay with a partner for life, even at great personal risk. When you understand this, I can't help but think people's hearts and minds would be much more open to showing that great compassion, towards our animals on this earth.
Yeah, that actually, Richard, that's the goal, is that I think you, if you read through the first part of the book and you're not just gobsmacked at how clever and wonderful and great they are, mm-hmm. and how emotional they are, mm-hmm. and their love and their loneliness and their grief and the way they figure things out, you get to the second part of the book, and that's all about, just as Peter is all about, let us make it easy for you. Here are things you can do.
Yes.
So that instead of buying the down pillow from the goose or the Canada goose jacket with the geese feathers inside, you can buy something else that's warmer, lighter, and so on.
Yes.
So that's the second part.
Yeah, actually, I love the way this book was organized, and I want to dive a little deeper into some of these sections, but you're right, the first part is about the remarkable discoveries about these animals, so you are in awe over, I had no idea they did that or felt that or those kind of things, and then the second part is, all right, now that we know that, and hopefully your heart is open a little bit, let's look at all the areas where we've been abusing these animals, and here's how we don't have to do that. So I love how this is all laid out.
Oh, thank you. That's very nice. Well, I tried to make it easy because we're great facilitators at PETA. If you are a teacher or you have a child in school or you are a child in school,
yeah.
and someone says, "Ooh, dissection is coming up,"
yeah.
we say, "Let me show you all the choices you have. Let me tell you where mm-hmm. the frogs come from." Mm-hmm. I mean, we're losing frogs the way we're losing bees in this world. It's mm-hmm. an ecological problem.
Mm-hmm.
But let me also tell you, there's a thing called sin frog, which is a synthetic frog. It doesn't come in formaldehyde like the real thing. And so there's none of the smell and the chemical. You just cut it open. It's got a membrane like a real frog. And with your forceps, right there in the classroom, you can just pick up the organs and remove them as you would with a real frog, but you kill nothing, and you learn without the yuck factor, and you can reuse the frog. It's just fantastic.
Well, and you talk a lot about other things much like that in the second half of the book, and it makes you wonder, if we have access to things like this, why aren't we using them?
Well, I think there are two things, and one is that certainly me, have grown up with this huge advertising by big companies who do things one way.
Mm-hmm.
And it's the same in experimentation. In the old days, you know, someone gets on a track to do a certain experiment, say on monkeys or rabbits, and they just carry on doing it for a whole career lifetime. No one ever taps them on the shoulder and says, "Excuse me, you're not finding out anything here."
Yeah.
And in fact, we've got a new film that just came out of three PhDs who were forced to use animals in no uncertain terms. They had to use animals to get their doctorate.
Mm-hmm.
And they, all three of them, didn't know each other, questioned this and said, "Why would I have to do this? Is this that seems just show and tell?"
Mm-hmm.
And they were told, just do it. And now deeply regret that they did it. So I think it's old habit,
yes,
that dies hard. It's big business,
yes,
that dies hard. And then these innovations have to be demanded. And so people have to know about them and ask their supermarket or their science lab,
mm-hmm.
"Well, anybody, I want this." And then it'll start to be more and more available and obvious.
Yes, yes. In this first section of the book, it's broken down into four or five, you know, sub-chapters. And I'd like to dive into one of the sub-chapters because we talk a lot about the art of love and life on this program. John Robbins, by the way, has been on this program four different times. And it was his groundbreaking book, that he wrote 25, 26 years ago that started to open up my eyes. And especially when I learned that the pig, for example, the pig is one of the most intelligent animals on the face of the earth. And I didn't know that until someone brought that to my attention, because why would I? People don't talk about those things.
Yes, I know. And I love John. And I actually remember sitting on an airplane and reading that first book all those years ago,
yeah.
And he opened my eyes in the same way I want to open people's eyes with this book. Yeah, pigs are phenomenally intelligent. I think most people know, you know, pigs have rescued children who from a pond or from a house fire. And so they're also empathetic. They really care. They're altruistic. They will risk themselves to help others.
Mm-hmm.
And until recently, and this is true of so many animals, we thought they just grunted and snorted and so on. But we have now identified at least 48 different sounds that they make that convey messages to each other. And, you know, we don't even understand really one or two of them.
Yeah.
So, and they are loving, especially of their piglets, which makes your heart break when you think how you get bacon and how those mother pigs are in those awful, what they call Iron Maidens, where they can't turn around and their piglets are not even able to. They can never nuzzle their mother and she can never nuzzle them.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, and I know it helps your cause a lot when you see things like Ellie Lacks, who's been on the program, founder of the Gentle Barn out in California. I love what Jon Stewart, who is so popular because of the Comedy Channel, he and his wife totally devoted to what we're talking about and what you've been about with PETA and what you're writing about in this book.
Yeah, Jon really got it. He had the experience of going to a sanctuary. I think his wife probably dragged him to it.
Probably.
And he saw the animals. He really seems to have fallen in love with them, which you can't help doing because sanctuary animals, they really radiate gratitude. They've come from some hellish experience. They've fallen off the back of a truck or they've been found downed, you know, crippled in a slaughterhouse and have been rehabilitated.
Yeah.
And he just seems to have fallen in love with these animals. And then, of course, he has the means. So he and his wife started their own sanctuary in upstate New York. And if a bull, say, there was a case, I think there have been three cases, a bull escapes from the slaughterhouse truck and barrels down the highway, and everybody's after that bull with guns, John will step in and say, "I'll take the bull. Don't hurt the bull."
Yeah.
And that's what he does.
Yeah, I know. I think that's amazing. One of the sub-chapters is called The Intricacies of Love. And there was a quote in there from, again, someone else who's been on the program because I just love what he's doing, and that's Mark Beckoff. And he says, "To me, the evidence for animal emotions is impossible to deny, and that is widely supported by our current knowledge in animal behavior, neurobiology, and evolutionary biology." What are a story or two you could share that you have documented in this book, documenting about animals and the love that they have as powerful as human love?
Oh, for sure. And I love Mark, too. And Mark gave me a beautiful endorsement for this book, by the way.
He did, yes.
He's very, very good. And he works a lot with Jane Goodall. And so my first example, I suppose, I would give you something about chimpanzees.
Mm-hmm.
I learned so much about chimpanzees, and I already knew a lot about them. So I think there's something for everybody to learn. One of the things I did know about them is they beat college students in memory tests.
Oh.
You know, they have a test where they put up all these pictures on a big board, like a video board, and then they take them away suddenly, and then you have to figure out how to put them back in the right place or which ones were where.
Yeah.
The chimpanzees beat the college students every time because I think they almost have a photographic memory, which means you should never show them your ATM PIN number. But chimpanzees, they're just like us. They kiss.
Mm-hmm.
Somebody came up with three ways to question how much like other animals, because we are an animal, biologically speaking, that's what we are. We're not a god, we're an animal.
Mm-hmm.
How much like the other animals we are. And one of the three things was, do you kiss? And chimpanzees kiss, and they kiss passionately, and they also bus kiss the way you do at a cocktail party.
Mm-hmm.
And if they meet another chimpanzee who they know casually, but they're not really close to, they'll do exactly what you see two people meeting at the bus stop or in the office, is that they will hug a little bit and just pat the back gently.
Oh.
But they also, they cheat on their wives.
They do.
They do, and they're very sneaky about it. And I think they could, then maybe they learned that from U.S. congressmen. I don't know.
Well,
but they did something. They do that.
There's a story you tell, which we'll get into a little bit. It's in the second part of the book, but you mentioned Jane Goodall. But you wrote in this book, and I did not know this again. This was about movies, using animals in movies, and about chimps. And you wrote, "Few of us have any idea what goes on behind the scenes. The sweet grin that we see chimps make on the screen is what Dr. Jane Goodall calls a fear grimace." Almost makes me cry just reading it. "As chimpanzees do not bare their teeth out of joy." There's really fear. Yeah.
And one of the worst things, years ago, you remember a chimpanzee went into space.
Yes.
And when he came back, he did make it alive, unlike the poor dog, Laika, who went up there and died. But he came and other monkeys went up there. Chimpanzee is an ape, but other monkeys went up there and died. But this chimpanzee came back to Earth. And you just imagine what it must be like when we don't know their language and you can't convey to them. We're doing our best. So he was strapped in. He had all sorts of tubes in him. He had, you know, and the whole capsule, this was early days of space, which is why they sent him, was shaking, and the noise and the heat and everything else. But he made it back, a splashdown. They took him, and when they opened the capsule door and he came out, there's a famous photograph of him. And it's him, quote, grinning from ear to ear. It wasn't. That was what Goodall calls the fear grimace. Absolutely petrified, showing all teeth. Don't hurt me. Don't hurt me. And they put him in a zoo, in a cell, by himself. I mean, he's a primate. He's a social animal who wants companionship. He wants to groom and touch and be with others. He was isolated as, look, here's the chimpanzee who went into space. And he stayed in that cell for decades. And in the last few years of his life, petitioning was successful, and he was able to come out and go to a sanctuary and for the first time be with other chimpanzees.
Yeah, it breaks my heart. Would you agree that the root... You know, as a former old school activist, now I would prefer to call myself a sacred activist, leading out of love and not hate, but still wanting to make a difference. I came to see that the root of all of this is a lack of reverence of life, the kind of reverence of life that Schweitzer talked about.
Absolutely. And Schweitzer, I mean, could teach us so much in his humility and his service. And his just respect for all the geese and the ducks who used to come to his clinic in Africa and be treated for, you know, a problem with a wing or a foot. He looked after all forms of life.
Yeah.
And as you say, he had that ethic. And my mother had a similar thing. When I was growing up, she did work for Mother Teresa in India. She did work with the leper colony, with unwed mothers. But she also, we stopped the car. Anytime, this is in India, we stopped the car anytime she saw a limping horse or she saw a dog with mange or whatever it was. And she used to say, always remember, it doesn't matter who suffers, it's that they suffer. And do something.
Yeah. Yeah, Louis Schwartzberg, I thought about him in preparation of having conversation with you, because he's using his cinematography of nature to hopefully grow a lot of environmentalists in the world, because he was the one that said, I believe in a TED talk, and I might be misquoting a bit, but something to the effect of, it's only when you fall in love with something that then you can't help but want to protect it. And that's what you're about. That's what's caused you to literally do the work that you're doing now, but you felt you fell in love with the animals.
I did, and I've always had that love. Perhaps, Richard, I don't know, but when I was born, there was already a dog called Shawnee in my family. Mm-hmm. He was there before I got there, and we grew up together. He was a little older than me, but we slept on the same bed, or I slept in his basket. We went out together in the car to various places. We both got car sick at the same time, always. And we just loved each other. If I was sad, he was sad. And if he was happy, together we were a pair, brother and sister.
Yeah.
And I loved him with all my heart. And I think when I look at any animal, through the fur and the feathers and the scales, because fish, they have a heart, they have eyes, they have thoughts, I see a person. And we just did a wonderful video with RZA from the Wu-Tang Clan, in which he says, there's somebody in there. No matter what the package looks like, inside that package, there's a someone. And so, yes, I care about them, and I never, ever want to see them mistreated. So my whole life, I'm just working hard as I can to say to people, please find out about them. You will be so amazed at how wonderful they are.
Yeah.
You will fall in love, and then you can help them.
Yeah, so I guess that would be your answer to the question I had, and that is, how do we help people on the front end fall in love with nature, fall in love with animals, so they can't help but want to protect them?
I think getting to know their abilities is a very important part, because in the past, people have been able to dismiss animals. The way, I mean, frankly, women were just thought to be good for the bedroom or the kitchen and not much else. They weren't allowed to vote. They couldn't own property. They were put down. People of color were just dismissed out of hand as stupid. And I mean, we look back at our history and we are deeply ashamed at the stupid thoughts that we had. And I think we're at the point now where it's speciesism. We need to shake off that human idea that we are so special and all the other animals are silly, unimportant, just something that we can have in our home or a pet. I mean, it's fine to have a companion animal, but they are whole living beings, not surrogate children. They are very bright, and they're looking at you. And the average dog in your home can understand 300 human words without being taught one. So we need to shake off that old way of viewing others and start thinking, maybe there's more I should know about them, and when I do, I'll come to respect them, and then I'll know that I need to help them, at least not hurt them.
People like Father Richard Rohr, who advocates contemplation and action, he would probably even add to our discussion and say, but you first need to develop a habit of at least stepping away from the craziness of life and contemplating a bit every day, meditating, or even just a little bit of silence, so you can reflect on the beauty of what you just read about that animal, or when you this time really, truly looked into the eyes of your animal companion, cat or dog. Because I find that a lot of times we just live life. It's crazy, busy lifestyles.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, if you want to unwind, what is nicer, to me anyway, of getting somewhere where you're away from traffic, you're away from people, you're out walking by the side of a river or in the woods, and you might hear bird song, and you smell the beauty of the woods or the flora. That rests your mind and allows good thoughts to come into your head.
Yeah.
But what you just said was interesting, because I've always loved this idea that when you look into the eyes of an animal, you should see a reflection of self coming back to you. They're not tables. They're not chairs. There is a living being there looking back at you. It's a reflection of yourself. I tried to make the book very upbeat, because I don't want to depress people.
Yes.
But I will say that this isn't in the book, but I know that people who go out to these pig save and chicken save and cow save vigils and just stand in silent contemplation outside the doors, the gates of a slaughterhouse, and watch the trucks come through, and sometimes in summer we'll lean in and give the pigs or whoever is coming through a drop of water on that long journey, that something happens to them where they look into the eyes of those animals, knowing they're going to die, and they have an epiphany of thinking, I've got to do something to stop this. They are wonderful, and they don't deserve this.
You know, it wasn't until maybe 4 or 5 years ago that I was educated through a group locally that were saving racehorses that no longer were making the money for the owners. And, you know, oftentimes they're abused then, and or they're sent to meat factories. And so these people were trying to save as many as possible. And again, it's the knowledge, I think, of what's really taking place. And I would agree with you. And by the way, for all our listeners, I really encourage you to pick up a copy of this book because it is done in a very positive way. I mean, I was amazed of all the other things I've learned from all these other animals, how they communicate, how they navigate. As I said, the love, I mean, it was just, it opens up your heart. And I began to see even the squirrels in my backyard in a different way in the last couple of days as I was diving into this book. But then in the second part, and you hit it hard, but you also offer alternatives. And that's what I, again, love about what you've done here. For example, under Revolutionary New Ways to Show Compassion, let's talk a little bit about scientific research, because I think a lot of people, if they hear any horror stories about animals, it's often what is done to animals in the name of science and research. Can you touch on that a little bit?
Yes, absolutely, because I think I mentioned to you, I saw it, this common myth, a few animals used for vital medical purposes to save lives, and kept comfortably and well. And then when I began to inspect laboratories, and since then, of course, PETA has, I think, 1,100 medical experts in various disciplines, I've learned so much about the enormity of it. It's millions of animals used every year. And at the moment, for example, even though we have things like whole human organs on a chip, a little microchip, that you can bombard with chemicals, for example, and see how a human organ would relate. We actually have slivers of a human brain that we have developed in a petri dish. We have whole human DNA on the internet. I mean, we have high-speed computers now that are programmed with human experience, human information, and it can tell us very quickly what drug or what cocktail of drugs will help a human condition. We can step away if we want to, and many scientists are, but as I say, there are many who are just stuck in the old ways. What we're fighting now, one of the many tests, is this ridiculous one called the forced swim test. And that's where they take little animals, drop them into beakers of water with solid sides so they can't get out, and they simply record how long it takes them to stop swimming. And that, believe it or not, Richard, that forced swim test has been conducted by pharmaceutical companies, universities, for decade after decade after decade. And we've just said, excuse me, why are you doing this? And we now have Pfizer, Bristol Myers Squibb, King's College London, all these places saying, oh, well, right, no, we'll stop doing that. That's right, we don't need that.
Yeah.
And just think what the animals have been through. So one thing people can do that's so easy. When I started and when PETA began, there were, I think, three companies that didn't test down animals' throats or in their eyes. Three of good companies. It's now 4,300 companies. And we've got a cruelty-free list. Just never buy anything that's tested on animals. Just refuse to buy it and tell the company why you're not buying it, and that'll change them.
Yeah. Well, in speaking about refusing to buy it, cruelty to animals in the name of fashion comes in many forms as well, and you do cover that in depth. Can you share a little bit about that to help us awaken, I think, to perhaps purchases we shouldn't be making?
Yes, that's a big surprise. I think unless you live in a cave somewhere, you've heard about fur.
Yeah.
So I think everybody's got it when it comes to fur. If you see someone in a fur, they either really don't care or they did live in a cave. But it's sad fact is when an animal becomes a piece of clothing, or a part of an animal is made into a piece of clothing, you could just say, I wonder if that was given up voluntarily. And I think you've got your answer, because often the animal is killed for that. And if you look at meat production, a lot of people know how disgusting slaughterhouses are, how disgusting factory farms are, and they won't buy the stuff. But the bigger profit in the slaughter of a cow comes from the hide. So it's not as if it's just something they were going to throw away. They're getting a chunk of money for that hide. Mm-hmm. And we're not survivalists. We don't need to clothe ourselves in animal skins.
Yeah.
But what's really surprising, and my socks were knocked off by some of our investigations, rabbits for Angora tied down and plucked alive in China. And the rabbits, like pigs, scream, and you just can't stand it. Then goats for mohair and for cashmere tied down, and with a big raking comb, they have their hair pulled out from them. Geese, some of them are live plucked, again, mostly in China, Korea, but a lot of them, it's just a slaughterhouse product.
Yeah.
We've got fabulous alternatives to all these things. The animals need their skin, they need their wool, they need everything.
Yeah.
And Richard, one more thing is, and I'm sorry to bring this up, but wool, people say to us, oh, it's just a haircut, isn't it? And you can understand that people would think that.
Mm-hmm.
But I've been in the shearing sheds, and we have videotaped on every continent there is in shearing sheds except Antarctica, where they don't happen to shear sheep. And every single time, we have found the men, it's men, who are shearing, they're professional shearers, they are working at such speed, they'll take off a teat, an ear, a part of a tail, and they lose their temper with the sheep because the sheep struggle, and they smash them in the face with the clippers, stand on their necks, and even twist their necks, and sometimes kill them.
Yeah.
Don't need it.
That's where it gets a bit overwhelming for me, because what you described in terms of angry workers, to be honest with you, I have extensive hospice background. I've seen that happen to human beings in our nursing homes.
Oh, yes.
Because of that lack of reverence that I see so prevalent, unfortunately, in today's world.
And, Richard, you're absolutely right. It's one thing, is because I've seen it in jails. I've locked up in Pennsylvania a couple of times for protesting the pigeon shoot, which the KKK used to come out in full regalia back then and for the pigeon shoot. And we would be arrested. And the jailers, when you're coming through being processed, some of them, they have that bullying, domination thing. They know that you are helpless. And you see that in nursing homes. You see it in jails. You see it in orphanages. Home care for care facilities for the elderly. You see it in dog kennels.
Yeah.
Horse racing. Is anything where you dominate, there are bullies. And that is so frightening when the animals, in this case, are totally helpless.
Yeah. And regarding the clothing for animals, it is gratifying. You list a number of major fashion designers who are taking a stand against real fur. Michael Kors, Gucci, Tom Ford, Tommy Hilfiger, Giorgio Armani. I've always loved what Paul McCartney's daughter, and by the way, Paul is one of the many people that have endorsed this book. He says, like me, Ingrid believes in protecting all the creatures we love. His daughter, Stella McCartney, has launched a line.
She's fantastic, and she was always ahead of her time, because her mother, Linda McCartney, would never harm a hair on an animal's head. She was fantastic, member of ours for her lifetime. What is so exciting is not just Stella anymore, and all the major designers have abandoned fur, finally.
Mm-hmm.
But we are getting now all these young designers coming up, and you may not even realize it, but handbags and coats and even belts and shoes made from grape leather, pineapple leather, apple leather, tea leather, made from nettles, from recycled. Well, look at Kors. What's happening there is that, you know, it can take up to 8 cows for for a car interior. Mm-hmm. And people are saying nowadays, I don't want it. So we have now, I think VW is coming out with their SUV next year is the interior is from recycled fishing nets. So you see all these car companies stepping away from leather, all these new fibers, there's hemp and there's cotton and there's jute. All these other things are coming in place of stealing from the animals or killing animals for fabric.
Yeah, it's all about being wise consumers and being careful where we spend our dollars. And books like this, organizations like PETA, if they get on your website, there is information out there now to help people live that way. They don't have to say, well, what else do I do? You know, there is information available.
Yeah. And in the book, and thank you for mentioning the website, because there are even cruelty-free clothing guides that we put out, and a free vegan starter kit, free alternative list for dissection, you name it.
Yeah. Well, let's talk about the entertainment industry for a minute. How rampant has been cruelty of animals in our movies and our TV shows in the past?
It's just really been a free-for-all. Some people may remember those old tripwires that they used to have in the old westerns where the horses would fall, and you'd think, gosh, that's exciting. And, of course, it was invisible. You couldn't see them, tripwires. And often the horses would break their legs, and they would be put down. The death toll among animals in the movies has been steadily declining because of pressure from the public.
Yes.
PETA has had a huge campaign about this. We write to every producer, every director, everybody about this, screenwriters, because in the old days, they used to, and the old days, not being that far back, used to use baby chimpanzees all the time, for example. And you never knew they were babies, but they were babies because you can never handle an adult chimpanzee. They're at least 10 times as strong as you. Yeah. They could pull you up into a tree if they wished. But the babies are taken from their mothers, and they are trained using, in one case, we saw sawed-off pool cues were used to hit them and jab them. Sometimes they'd have their teeth taken out. They'd have an electric shock collar under the clothing that they were wearing. All that is really gone now because we've pushed it aside. We now have computer imagery that we use and blue screen. And so that film, Noah's Ark, I think had every animal under the sun in it, and none of the animals were real. They were all computer imagery. So we've changed the face of the use of animals in entertainment. You still catch a few things, like somebody running through the pigeons or running into a market where there are chickens, and they shouldn't do any of that. There's no excuse for it anymore.
Yeah. Well, with science like animatronics and so many other things, there is no need to use animals anymore. So I'm hoping that will be an upward trend more and more in the entire entertainment industry. And it really does help, courtesy, I think, of what PETA is all about. You've attracted a lot of big-name celebrities who have been very vocal about that and refuse to be in productions that are going to be mistreating animals.
You know who has just done a wonderful thing, and he's constantly helping with the use of animals in entertainment, is Alec Baldwin.
Oh, yes.
He, there was a sportsman's club in Pennsylvania where they had this poor old Asian bear called Dylan in a cement cage, and he had rotted teeth. He must have been in terrible pain, rocking back and forth. He at least 400 pounds overweight because he had no exercise. He wasn't allowed to hibernate, which bears do. And he just sat there all day and rocked. And Alec Baldwin joined our campaign, wrote to the governor, wrote to the newspaper, wrote to the club, and just the day before yesterday, we got Dylan out. He's now at a Colorado animal sanctuary for exotic animals, a wild animal sanctuary, and he's undergoing veterinary care. He's eating fresh fruits, and he's able to walk around, and he's going to shed that weight.
Yeah. That's wonderful. That's wonderful. Well, you know, we've talked about clothing choices and entertainment choices and also trying to encourage more and more businesses and industries not to use animals for scientific research. Let's talk about something that is very practical because we all need it, and that is food choices. You even had a list in there of vegan animals. There are some pretty big animals that don't require meat, such as gorillas.
Yes, you have to laugh when someone says, oh, I need my meat for my strength. And you say, gosh, tell that to the stallion or the gorilla or, yeah, you know, all the bison, for example. We're not carnivores. I mean, lions, big cats, tigers, those are true carnivores. We're primates. And primates do not need milk after infancy. And when they're infants, they need their own mother's milk. Mm-hmm. And they don't need meat. You know, they need the things that are natural, plant foods, fruits, vegetables, nuts, all grains, those sorts of things. But what has happened to us, of course, it's come back to bite us. I mean, we look at the rates of obesity, diabetes, high blood pressure, cancers, heart disease, the killers. And they're wiping out, you know, 3 out of 4 people will come down with those things. And what's it all go back to? Diet. So we have, in the book, I talk about the various ways in which animals become food, and it's not pleasant. Mm-hmm. But I also talk about how easy it is to veganize your favorite dishes and how today you can walk into Dunkin' Donuts this afternoon and there's the Beyond Burger being sold.
Yes,
or
yes.
You can go to Hardee's. You don't have to go somewhere fancy.
Yeah.
You don't have to go to a co-op or something the way you did in the old days. Your supermarket is full of oat milk and soy milk and almond milk and all these things and all these taste-alikes to help you transition away from the foods that you're used to and not miss a thing. In fact, discover so much because animals, honestly, they should be our friends. They shouldn't be on our plates. And they're just like us. And it's almost like cannibalism to be eating them.
Yes. So there's actions people can take. The first action is getting educated and knowing there's a better way and actually a healthier way, especially when it comes to food. And I have to say, I'd say in the last decade, we've made major strides. As you mentioned, there's so many chain restaurants now that offer vegan options and healthy options where we didn't have that 20, 30 years ago.
Oh, it's almost impossible not to find vegan food because even a steakhouse these days, mm-hmm. and I'm not saying go to one, but should you happen to be in one, they have the best market vegetables, and they will gladly make you a plate of spinach and baked potato and green beans and mushrooms and tomatoes and onions and peas and all these things. And people may say, well, those are just the vegetables. After a time, you come to really appreciate the beauty and the succulency and everything else of fresh vegetables that are well chosen and well prepared.
Yeah.
But yeah, you can get something everywhere.
So Ingrid, with all the work that you have done for a good part of your life, are you optimistic for the future?
Oh, yes. I mean, I've seen so many changes, and I'm very excited about the interest people have in not harming animals and in learning about them. I look back to when we started and all the things that were going on that when we brought them up and people said, oh, I don't know about that. And today, especially young people are ready to say, why were we doing that to animals? That is uncivilized. That was just unthinking. And that was basically ignorance. So I'm seeing all the changes in food and clothing and entertainment and science. I really have enormous hope. The biggest circus on the face of the earth, a Ringling Brothers closed shop. Laws are being passed banning the bullhook that's used to intimidate elephants. Mm-hmm. And laws are being passed to ban foie gras, which is made by force-feeding ducks and geese. And laws are being passed to ban exotic skins. And all these things are happening because people have woken up. They've seen the videos on the internet of how fabulous animals are. And some of that, I've tried to put the best parts of that into the book so people will go, oh, yes, oh, look at that. I didn't know that bird could do that.
Yes. Yes. Well, I'm sensing that the fire in your heart for this cause is just stoking hotter and hotter. You're not slowing down at all, are you?
No, not in the least bit. No, I have crow's feet, but that's I still have the same figure.
Well, I want to say for my listeners, Animal Kind, this book isn't just for people who get it or are already part of the tribe, but this is a wake-up book for people to understand more how they can live actually a healthier life, a better life, and contribute to more greater sustainability in this planet. Again, the book is Animal Kind, Remarkable Discoveries About Animals and Revolutionary New Ways to Show Them Compassion. And Ingrid, give them a website for them to go to learn more about this and the work of PETA.
The PETA.org website probably has every resource you could ever need, and if you can't find it, then there's a place to ask a question, and we will help you in any way we can. And if you can, if you use a library, please ask your local librarian to stock Animal Kind so that lots of other people, especially young people, can read it. But it's not for young people, it's for everybody.
Ingrid Newkirk, I want to thank you so much for the gift of another great book, and also for the work that you are doing in our world. It is much needed, and you've honored me being on this program today.
The honor is all mine. Thank you, Richard, very much.
Once again, the book is Animal Kind, the author, Ingrid Newkirk, and for more information, go to PETA.org. You know, there's a preciousness about life that we've lost and must reclaim. Somewhere along the journey, we've increasingly stopped seeing one another and animals as magnificent extensions of ourselves, needing respect, care, and love. So in closing, I'd like to share a prayer. Dear God, my guide of love and light in all that is sacred, I've spent too much time seeing through darkened eyes, eyes that are mean, eyes that are judgmental, eyes that keep me apart from others. I no longer want to stay in this cold, lonely place. Give me new eyes to fully see the precious around me. Every day, I have the opportunity to see what's really true, to see what really matters. Let me see as I've never seen before the true divine essence of all. Give me new sight so I can fall in love with the beauty and tenderness and connectedness of all. Please let me open my eyes wide to see the gift I have within, to be love. St. Francis of Assisi once said, "The one you've been looking for is the one who is looking. The love we have been seeking is inside us." Please give me new eyes so I can recognize and delight in and be the love inside myself. Please give me new eyes so I can recognize and delight in and truly see the love inside others. Let me fall into love with all that is. Let me see all as sacred. Let me see with a loving heart. Let me see that God is in all things. When St. Francis walked the hills of Assisi, he stopped in front of a cherry tree and he said, "O little tree, speak to me of God." And the little tree burst into bloom. Soften my eyes so I can see that we're all blossoms of God. Make my eyes so tender that whenever I look on someone else, or whenever I watch the moon at night, or whenever I see the blue heron along the river, or whenever I look on those right before me, I see God looking back at me. And that's today's program. I want to thank you for joining me today. I especially want to thank my awesome engineer, Kyle Intalli, and the amazing production coordinator, Angel Richardson. I'm Richard Brendan. You've been listening to Journey's Fire. We're inspiring the fire within you, one broadcast at a time.